Dear listener, before we start today's episode, I want to tell you about a resource I've created, which I want to share with you for free. I'll tell you what it is and how to get it. If you're not already writing tests for your Rails code, you're probably aware that testing can help you ship your work faster and with fewer defects. Because testing is such an in-demand skill, but since so few developers know how to do it properly, I've created a resource for you called The Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing. This guide is a short, downloadable book which answers the most common Rails testing questions that beginners tend to have, including, which testing framework should I use, RSpec or Minitest? What level of test coverage should I shoot for? What are the different kinds of Rails tests? What are all the Rails testing tools, and how do I use them? My guide covers these questions and several others. To get the Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing, go to railstestingguide.com. Now on to the episode. Today I'm here with Jared White. Jared, welcome to the show.
Hey, Jason. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Do you want to introduce yourself for us?
Sure. Yeah. I'm a Ruby developer, web developer. I'm based in Portland, Oregon. And I have my own freelance web studio called White Fusion. I've been working in this industry for what seems like forever. So I've seen a lot of stacks come and go and a lot of trends come and go. But for some reason, you know, when I came across Ruby back in the mid-2000s and really got into Rails development, I've never wanted to let go of that. And I think, actually, as a quick bit of follow-up maybe from a previous episode, you were talking with Peter Cooper, and he mentioned sort of perception of a lull in the Ruby community maybe around 2015 or 2016. And I noticed that too, and I became a bit concerned. And I think that was right around the time when React hadn't quite fully taken off yet, and people were still talking about Angular. Or maybe it was a little bit before that. But anyway, early 2010s, like Angular was sort of on the rise and React hadn't quite broken out yet. And so I was starting to get lots of advice from people saying, oh, you should learn Angular. This is the future. You know, Rails is going away and everything's going to be front-end heavy and JavaScript and all this kind of stuff. And I really kind of resisted that and pushed back and felt like maybe I was, you know, hurting my career in the process. But these days it feels like, you know, some of the thinking around all that has really turned around. And so I'm encouraged as a Ruby developer, and been fun doing a lot more in this community.
Yeah, I'm encouraged by the kind of return to sanity. There was the SPA craze, whenever that happened, like you said, mid-2010s, whatever. And people kind of realized that that wasn't actually all that great. And so now, you know, single-page applications have their place and their use case, but the idea that every web application should be a single-page application by default is not a good idea. And luckily, I think people now recognize that. And so we're going back to, at least in the Rails world, we're going back to the default of just a Rails application, not a single page application, which I think is great.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not just Rails or like backend frameworks that aren't JavaScript that are heading in this direction again. A lot of people in the JavaScript community are as well. You know, there's almost a framework du jour race again in the JavaScript world, but not like as in terms of front end frameworks. It's in terms of basically static site generators or something like that. That you know, even if you're using JavaScript based technologies for your templates and your routing and so forth, at the end of the day, it's by default building a website that's basically zero JavaScript. It's, you know, it's either statically or dynamically rendered routes and no JavaScript to start with, and then you can kind of opt in, like, oh, let's rehydrate this one component on this one page that needs to be interactive, and, you know, let's sort of target these different parts of certain pages, but the rest is little to no JavaScript. And I think, you know, as a web industry as a whole, I think this new focus on, you know, not just developer ergonomics, but performance and, you know, respecting users' resources on their own devices and all that sort of thing. Yeah, it's really encouraging.
Yeah. Yeah. And from a productivity standpoint, you know, Rails got popular largely because of the leverage that it gave developers. You could do a lot with just a little. You could use scaffolds to generate CRUD interfaces so quickly. And then even after your CRUD interfaces are generated, you can use Rails conventions to again, accomplish a lot with very little code. And if you go the SPA route, you're kind of throwing a lot of that out the window. And for example, if you have an Angular or React front end, then you have to code all that stuff from scratch. Like, and the conventions are less strong in those worlds, at least last time I checked. And so unlike a Rails application where you go into any Rails application and they're going to look pretty similar, my experience with Angular, I've never really done React, but my experience with Angular was that every project looked different because everybody just came up with their own structure. And that's not necessarily bad for each individual project, but for somebody who goes from project to project and you want to learn something, you want to get familiar and productive with a project quickly, that's hard when every single project is unique. And the convention philosophy that Rails has is not really present, at least in Angular. And so it's just a really wasteful way to code. And so, again, I'm really glad that people are getting away from that.
Yeah. Yeah. The convention over configuration thing really is, it's hard to overstate how valuable that is. And yeah, as a freelancer, you know, I in any given week and certainly in any given month, you know, I'm dipping into, you know, several, if not a dozen code bases. And having you know, the majority of that being Rails or, you know, or some kind of Ruby-based framework. Increasingly, it's Bridgetown, which I'm maybe mention in a moment. But having something that's, you know, a really good, solid set of conventions where it's not just reinventing the entire wheel.
Yeah. Yeah. And me and my guest on the last episode, we were talking about the term magic and how we didn't really like that term. I think it's kind of intellectually dishonest because it's a little bit derogatory, and it makes it sound like mysterious things are happening. And like I said in the last episode, it's not magic, it's just conventions. And there aren't a lot of conventions that you have to understand. The conventions you do have to understand aren't very complicated. And so once you learn those few things, like, oh, if I have a class like this, it corresponds to a database table with the same name, just underscores instead of camel case. That's not magic. That's just a principle, and it's a pretty easy principle to understand. And those
I think we can find words that are maybe more like expectations or assumptions.
Yeah, conventions.
Like you said, you know, casing things certain ways, you know, auto-loading certain, you know, base models that you can inherit from, like, you know, that shouldn't be thought of as magical. It should be sort of, you know, a principle that once you know it, you know, you really don't ever have to think about it again. Like, I don't go into a Rails code base and go, you know, oh my gosh, how can I have a database record inherit from, you know, Active Record base? Like, where does that come from? Like, once you know where it comes from, you never need to really think about that again. It's just a given.
Yeah. Yeah. And luckily, we're probably preaching to the choir, given the audience of this show. If you're using Rails, you're probably good with the conventions. And if you're not, if that kind of thing repulses you, then you're probably using some other technology.
Yeah. I don't have too much experience with JavaScript backends, but I have done a fair bit with some front ends. Primarily React and using Next.js as sort of a base layer for that. And the main project I'm on right now that where I do that kind of work, the back end is Nest.js, which is a fairly popular JavaScript back end. And I really try to avoid getting into that. Like I tell other folks on the team, like, I'm very happy for you to work on that side of the code base, and I'll just work on, you know, adding this button component. Because I go into like any file, whether it's like a controller or a database model or something like that, and just the amount of import statements at the top of the file, like you scroll and you scroll, like you get down to line 40 and maybe you get to some actual code that does something, and the rest is just imports and decorators and all this kind of boilerplate stuff. And you know, I know some folks, like, they like having that all spelled out and they like it being explicit, and it, you know, it certainly makes some aspects of using an IDE a little bit easier. But I can't handle it.
Yeah, you know, there were
files that are really clean and like only the code that I actually need to deal with.
There was something I liked about Angular. There were a number of things I liked about Angular, and one of them was its kind of dependency injection philosophy. So unlike Rails, where just everything is available all the time, no matter what, with Angular, if you want to make use of, let's say you have one JavaScript class and you're working in that class and you want to make use of some other JavaScript class, you have to explicitly import it, and then you have to, I forget exactly how it went, but you have to like pass an instance of that class or pass that class itself as an argument into the constructor of that object. And I actually liked that because, well, if you had a situation where you needed to inject like 9 different classes, that was kind of a sign that you were having one thing touch too many other things. And if you have one thing touch too many other things, then it increases the amount of stuff you have to understand in order to just understand that one thing. So the fewer couplings that you have from object to object, typically the easier something's going to be to understand. And so I thought that was good. And the other benefit that gave was in testing, this was more necessary with JavaScript stuff than it is with Ruby, but you could easily stub stuff out, so you could test only the part that you cared about and you didn't have to test the dependencies of the thing that you wanted to test. And so that was nice. But all things considered, I think I prefer, you know, it's all trade-offs and pros and cons, but I think I prefer the costs that come with auto-loading and everything always being available over the other way where you have to explicitly import everything and you end up, like you said, with files with a bunch of imports at the beginning.
Yeah, yeah. And there are honestly different concerns that you have to deal with front-end code versus back-end code just by the nature of the thing. So, like, if I'm truly sitting down to write a new component that's going to sit on a web page and it's a front-end component, like, it makes sense to be very thoughtful and careful not to import too much stuff, right? You don't want a lot of dependencies. You don't want to import too much stuff. You know, you kind of want to write the most streamlined version of the thing you can get away with, because, you know, every new thing you pull in is going to add to your bundle size. It's going to, you know, add to your overall JavaScript load on the page. So you want to be really careful, and you want to do all the tree shaking and all the buzzword for, you know, keeping those file sizes down. If you're writing code on the back end, who cares, right? You have, you know, virtually unlimited resources if you think about it, you know, perhaps bounded by ultimate costs of memory and CPU, but, you know, like, essentially on working in a back end framework, like, you know, you can import whatever you want, wherever you want, and you don't have to think too much about, you know, things like bundle size and transfer speeds and all that kind of stuff. So to me, the ergonomics of writing back-end code as if it were front-end code is, you know, that's where I get frustrated, because I feel like it's not acknowledging that, you know, this is a different environment with a different set of trade-offs. Let's take advantage of that.
So something else I wanted to talk about is, you know, we ranted about single page applications, and there's something else that I rant about quite a bit. And I want to not just rant about this, but actually offer some solutions and share how I do it, and I'm curious how you do it. And the topic is service objects, which I've, of course, written about and talked about on this podcast. And I think that, okay, so first of all, service object means different things to different people. I think most commonly when people say service object, they mean something like the command pattern. And I think it's a mistake to treat the command pattern as just a paradigm where you discover the command pattern and now you write all of your model code in the command pattern style now. That seems a little bit of a funny way to go. It's a pattern that has its use cases, and so if you need to write a new piece of code and you consider your options and you choose the command pattern, then okay, great, you've made a conscious choice, whatever. But if you just reflexively write all of your code that way out of ignorance, then I think that's a mistake. And so what I want to talk about is how do I write code? Since I don't use the command pattern very much, I don't have anything that I call a service object because that term is like overloaded and vague. But I do use the command pattern sometimes, but it's not like the main way that I write my code. So I want to share how I write my code, and I would love for you to share how you write your code as well. So with that, let me ask you, how do you structure your Rails applications and your Rails model code and all that stuff?
Yeah, so having the perspective of being a freelance developer, working on a lot of different projects, a lot of projects at different levels of, I would say, mastery of Rails. You know, some projects you go into that have already been written and you're brought in and you look at and you're like, you know, wow, okay, lots of good Rails conventions, you know, these people were clearly good Ruby programmers. They, you know, they knew what they're doing. And then other times you go into things and it is just, you know, closer to old school PHP spaghetti mess, you know, anything goes anywhere. So, you know, clearly that's sort of the world you want to avoid, right? So we're all trying to find ways to, you know, come up with these set of guidelines to structure code. The problem I've seen with service objects is you have to be incredibly disciplined, and I mean just almost unhumanly disciplined about writing them in such a way that they truly are these very tiny, you know, single use, single principle, you know, basically functions. They're not really even objects in an object-oriented programming sense. You know, these little functions of effort that, you know, are kind of all live in these very clearly named areas and do these very specific things. And to me, the only way I can see that working out is if you're building something. And I actually had a conversation with I believe Noah Gibbs on his podcast where he brought this up and it really resonated with me. And that is, like, maybe if you're building some kind of elaborate data processing pipeline where you need, like, you know, all these data inputs and then you have to have a series of operations and you kind of want to, like, save the order of those operations and audit them and maybe roll them back in the future, and it's kind of part of this, you know, special pipeline you've built, you know, then maybe it makes sense to have these very discrete little units of functionality that's, like, you know, pass in all the data, you know, do one thing to it and then spit out some new bit of data, and, like, that's all you're good for. I just don't see that pattern being relevant in most common web applications. You know, if you think of the typical sweet spot for Rails applications, you know, your CRUD app where, you know, someone's logging in and, you know, there's a bunch of different content types essentially, and you're, you know, saving and editing fields and you have some associations, and then maybe you want to generate some dashboards or some reporting and different things. Like, so much of that is really better served by what I kind of think of as sort of this series of entities where, you know, you have these domain models that represent the different pieces of your application, these different types of content or these different relationships. And, you know, if you structure it right, you can kind of, you know, you can create this object graph, kind of, you know, put the data into it that you need and almost hit like go, and everything kind of flows through. And it's really hard for me to describe this without sort of trying to create a visualization, but it's sort of this idea that like everything kind of flows through the object graph. And that's really how Rails works. Like Rails sets up this object graph of like, oh, you know, it handles the request through rack, and then it, you know, looks through its routes file, which has a nice DSL. And once it finds the right route, you know, it then instantiates the controller, and then the controller gets the request. And then you write the little bit of the controller that, you know, calls up the model. And now you have a model that talks to the database and gets the, it basically, you know, it Rails will construct this object graph for you. And you just kind of, you know, plug in the little pieces you need within that object graph, and the data just kind of flows all through it very naturally. And so I love this idea that you're writing domain models, you're writing these kind of entities that represent, you know, different concepts within your application. And it's less about operations, it's less about the verbs, and it's more about the nouns. And the data just kind of, you know, starts over here and ends up over there in a more organic fashion. So I really try to think of programming as a lot of nouns kind of, you know, interacting with each other through some kind of behavior, rather than sort of this, you know, do task A and now do task B and now do task C, and this sort of linear kind of, you know, almost procedural approach.
Yeah, I think that kind of goes back to the difference between imperative and declarative style, which I've talked about on this show before. To me, I find it very natural to write in an imperative style. Do this, then do this, then do this. But I find code often easier to understand when it's written in a declarative style. And it's kind of weird because the declarative style is like less natural. And it took me kind of years to like start writing my code in that style, or even to realize that I wanted to write my code in that style. And just to briefly reshare the illustration that I always use for that is like, if I want you, Jared, to make me a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and I tell you, okay, get two pieces of bread, put some peanut butter on one of them, put some jelly on the other, put them together, put it on a plate, and then give that to me. I've given you those instructions in an imperative style. But if I say a peanut butter and jelly sandwich is two pieces of bread with peanut butter and jelly in the middle, comes on a plate, give me one of those. That's a declarative style. And it's kind of a subtle difference. But when it's expressed in code, I think it makes a lot. It's easier to see the difference when you see it in code. And the reason I think it's easier to understand is because with something that's imperative, you have to keep track of things in your head. You have to start at step one and imagine, like, let's say there's 10 steps. You have to, okay, here's step one. I'm going to store this in my head. Here's what happened in step one. Here's how the world changed because of step one. Okay, I'm storing that in my head. Then you look at step two. You say, okay, this thing happened in step two. It happened this way in step one. So now there's this in step. Okay, things just changed this way. All right. And then as you go through the steps, you have to like keep track of what must have happened. Whereas with declarative, there are fewer moving parts, and so you don't have to do that. That's my hypothesis anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally get what you're saying. And I think an example of imperative versus declarative that we're all familiar with and we don't know it. And I recently wrote an article about this because even I, like, it's taken me how many years to even sort of have these thoughts form in my mind? Look at HTML. HTML essentially is a declarative language. What you're describing as you write HTML is essentially an object graph, and each of these objects is a certain kind of object and it has certain properties, but we don't really think of it that way. We just think like, oh, I'm writing a P tag and it has a class, and now I'm writing an H2 tag, and now I'm, you know, writing a button, and a button has a type and it has a value, and yeah, you know, we kind of write this out in this declarative way. But what we're really saying is, hey, computer, take this and analyze it and figure out the imperative steps you need to take to turn this into something usable. And you could write that yourself by hand. Like you could just, instead of writing HTML, create a JavaScript file and say, you know, document.createElement P and then say P add child and create a text node. And now add the text node to as the child of that paragraph. Like you could write out all the imperative steps to construct an HTML document. But you know, nobody wants to do that because it's so verbose and it's, you know, so outrageous when we have this beautiful declarative sort of DSL, if you will, for a web page. So you know, when you think about like that, like as we're writing, you know, code in Rails, we're figuring out our domain models, we're figuring out our object graph. Again, like, yes, you could think of everything in terms of, you know, step one, then step two, then step three, and every step has, you know, a certain number of inputs and a certain number of outputs. But that's basically throwing object-oriented programming by the wayside, kind of saying we don't need any of those OOP principles. You know, we're going to do essentially something that's not that. And I think that's a shame because, you know, basically, when I first got into Rails, it was right around the time when I picked up a book called Patterns of Enterprise Architecture. And even though that was Java-based, and I didn't know too much about Java at the time, I really loved the idea that you could kind of look through this book and see like, oh, this particular pattern solves this particular kind of problem. And this other sort of pattern solves this other kind of problem. And one of the patterns in there was called Active Record. And when I saw that, it was just as I was starting to learn Rails. And I was like, wait, Active Record in Rails is this Active Record pattern. That's what they're doing to solve this, you know, impedance mismatch between objects and database records. Oh, this is so cool. So it kind of helped me see Rails initially as not just like, oh, here's a bunch of magical stuff that helps you build web apps, but more like, here's something that uses a series of patterns to solve all these specific problems it needs to do. You know, MVC is just one of many examples of a pattern. So again, like when you look at service objects and really we're talking about this command pattern, like that's just one pattern. So it might solve one particular problem you have, but to say that's going to solve all the problems is basically to say this isn't a pattern anymore. Because a pattern,
yeah, I think
by
to do that,
its nature, will only mm-hmm. solve one particular type of problem.
Right. I think to do that is to confuse the idea of a pattern and a paradigm. Because a paradigm is something like object-oriented programming or functional programming or whatever. And so if you take something like the idea of a service object or command pattern, or interactors are another popular one. People discover the interactor gem and they say, oh, we'll write all our code this way now. That's kind of taking that and treating it as a paradigm, which again, I think is a mistake because it's not really a paradigm. It's more of a pattern, and patterns have specific use cases.
Yeah. Yeah. So I would say, you know, if I were to go into a new code base and I saw that it had, you know, some kind of service object layer, I might be initially skeptical, but if I looked in there and saw that, oh, these are like a few specific things where that really was a good pattern for that kind of thing they're solving, you know, maybe this really is like financial transactions aspect of the project. And so, you know, you kind of want to have these like command patterns and an audit log of what operations took place when, and okay, like maybe that starts to make sense. But if I go into a project and I just see like, oh, you know, there's almost no code in a controller. Oh, there's almost no code in any model. They didn't do any non-active record modeling at all. Oh, pretty much all the code that does anything is just in app services with just like, you know, thousands of files. Like,
yeah.
That's, to me, that's just not even a Rails app anymore. That's something else, which maybe makes sense to them, but I'm not going to be super thrilled about that.
Well, and to say something is not a Rails app anymore, I think that's not necessarily bad, and I think every Rails app kind of gets there eventually anyway if it gets big enough. And I want to kind of explain what I mean, and I also have a hypothesis, Jared, and I want to hear if you think that this is the case or if you have maybe a different idea. But okay, here's how I think people maybe get there. When you start a Rails application, you have controllers, models, views, it all makes sense. You also have jobs, you have helpers, you have all these slots that things go in. And if you pretty much every need that you have, you pick it up and you say, oh, what's the shape of this need? Oh, this is a controller shaped thing. I'll put it in this controller shaped hole. Oh, this is a view shaped thing. I'll put it in the view shaped hole. But as your application grows, you run out of places to put things because, you know, there's that advice, skinny controllers, fat models, which is good advice because you don't want your controllers to be big and bloated and hard to understand. So people take that controller code and they push it down into the model layer. And I think they are right in doing that. But then if you just have one active record model per database table, and that's all you have in the app models folder, then code accumulates and you end up with models that are hundreds or maybe even over 1,000 lines long in some of your models. And that's bad too. And so people get to that point and they're like, okay, now we need something else. We need something other than models. We need another slot to put things in. And they discover this great thing called service objects that has worked for a lot of people. And I say, oh, here's another slot. We can use that. Now we'll put our model code there and things will be clean and tidy. So that's my guess as to how people arrive there. But it's, again, it's a mistake. And here's what I think is maybe a useful realization that people can make. Once your app grows to a certain size, Rails can't help you anymore. And in fact, no framework could help you anymore. Because a framework can help you, I think, with like two things. It can help give you leverage, and it can help you organize your code. And Rails can always help with the leverage part, because we can always... Rails's conventions never stop being useful. Routes and for some reason, I can't think of a single other convention, but you know what I mean? There's conventions, and we'll always be able to use those no matter how big the app gets. But with the code organization part, Rails can only help in the beginning, because as your app gets really big and really complicated, you're on your own to provide your own structure. And I think it can really help if people realize that, like, okay, for the first year, Rails can help me with the organization, but after that, I'm on my own, and I have to do something of my own devising that helps me organize my code. I think that could be really helpful. And I have more thoughts, but first I want to turn it over to you and see if you have any thoughts on all that stuff.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. And, you know, I know you're a big fan of Poros, you know, plain old Ruby objects, and sort of, you know, thinking of the idea that you can write, you know, essentially just straight up Ruby code in a variety of ways, kind of in its own, you know, area alongside your typical Rails, you know, database records, controllers, templates. But then, of course, the question is, you know, well, how do you structure that plain old Ruby code? And like you're saying, you know, it's kind of up to you at that point. One thing I think is really helpful for people, you know, if you audience member have been writing Rails for a while, but you have not done this yet, I definitely encourage you to try it out. And that's just create your own Ruby gem, whether that's as a Rails engine or whether that's just a plain Ruby gem. Because if you start out writing a gem to, you know, solve a particular problem, it really causes you to think through the interface between your internal gem code and what uses it. You know, so you have, you know, a bunch of code that gets things done within your gem, but you want your sort of API surface layer to be fairly minimal. So from the outside, you're just kind of maybe instantiating a single object, you know, passing it a few variables and saying, you know, do something and give this result back to me. So, you know, in that sense, the API surface layer of that kind of feels like a service object. It kind of feels like that command pattern maybe, but you don't have to structure the rest of your gem that way. That's just sort of this API division. And you hear people kind of talk about this sort of architectural thinking more broadly in terms of, you know, like service-oriented architecture. If you truly build an app that way where everything is some kind of service, you get into microservices, which I'm not really a fan of that idea, but you can sort of simulate microservices in a way. If you have a main Rails app, you kind of start breaking off bits of functionality into their own gems. And so that really forces you to think of each of these parts of your functionality as its own unit of functionality with this very, you know, thin sort of API surface layer between the two. So that, to me, might be a better fit for the times when people start wanting to reach for service objects. You know, oh, get this code out of my models, get this code out of my controllers. It needs to kind of live over here and do its own thing. And the main part of the app shouldn't really know too much about it. And that whole area shouldn't know too much about the main app. Like, to me, that sounds like a perfect candidate to create a separate gem. And, you know, if it's just a private gem only for this one app, that's totally fine. But, you know, create that as its own Ruby project and then pull that into your main Rails app. And I think that could ultimately be a better solution for that sort of need.
Well, here's what I might suggest to people, which is a similar suggestion to yours, which is build an application that's just Ruby that doesn't involve Rails or any framework. Like, build a tic-tac-toe game or like a Wheel of Fortune game or something like that, and just make it a command line Ruby application. Because when you're coding in Rails, let's say you're not a very good programmer yet and you want to build something in Rails, you build something in Rails, how do you know how good it is? Like, your code is kind of mixed with Rails code, and even somebody else looking at it, they're like, okay, well, all you needed to add to accomplish this was to run some scaffolds, add some associations, a couple custom lines. There's not like a lot there that's just your own stuff. And so flaws can hide fairly easily. But if you write a program that's just Ruby and involves no framework, there's nowhere for any of your bad code to hide. And if you don't know how to structure your code, it's going to be painfully obvious. And so that's what I would suggest to people, because it might throw things into sharp relief and it might make you realize, like, oh yeah, when I have all this code that's just my own custom code, I need to structure it somehow. And then you can take those lessons back to Rails and organize things in a similar way. Because for me, if I'm writing a plain Ruby program that doesn't involve any Rails, or if I'm building a Rails app, I structure my code pretty much the exact same. I had another question for you. Oh, yeah. I want to ask you about models, because I think this is another area. Okay. So at the risk of being unfair to Rails developers or mean or something, I'm not trying to be mean, but I think a lot of Rails developers maybe don't have a lot of exposure to object-oriented principles or certain other programming principles, because maybe Rails is all they've ever done or whatever reason. What do you think of, Jared, when you think of the concept of a model? What does that mean to you?
Yeah, that's a big, broad question. Real quick, I just want to say I agree with you about this idea of kind of building your own mini Rails, if you will, as an exercise. I've seen some articles come out fairly recently that are like examples of doing that, which I think are really cool. But yeah, so in terms of models, I really think of them as sort of the conceptual building blocks of your application. And to some degree, if you imagine explaining your application to somebody who's maybe non-technical and you're trying to sort of, you know, explain to them how it works and what it does, you know, you're going to start using a fair amount of terminology that I think you can then go back and examine as a way of orienting your model. So, you know, if you're, say, you're building a new, you know, photography social network, it's going to be the next big thing on the App Store. If you think about the domain models of that, you know, you're going to start out with some obvious things, like you need photographs. Like, a photograph is an entity in your system. You know, it's a concept. It's something tangible. Maybe that photograph has tags. You know, people want to add hashtags to their photographs. So a hashtag is a concept, and a photograph can have many hashtags. Maybe a hashtag itself is something people should be able to follow in addition to following photographers. So now hashtags have to be social, essentially. You can follow a hashtag. So as you're sort of thinking through these concepts and you're trying to maybe explain them to somebody else who's not a programmer and you just kind of want to explain to them what your app does, you know, you're going to naturally come across, you know, a lot of different terms. And if you then go back and kind of look at these terms and think through, like, okay, how do I actually write the code to handle all this stuff? You know, the thing that's so great about object-oriented programming is, instead of thinking of everything in terms of you know, functions, you know, acting upon input data and spitting out output data. Instead, you kind of start writing code, thinking through, you know, all of these concepts, all of the entities. So, you know, you probably need a class for a photograph. You need a class for a hashtag. You need a class for a user. You need a class for maybe the profile that's attached to a user that has their avatar and their biography, and maybe the avatar as an image is its own avatar class. And then maybe you need a base image class that avatar subclasses, and other images can also subclass. Yeah. Anyway, you start thinking through some of this stuff, and you know, none of this is particularly Rails specific or any framework specific. It's just the kind of domain modeling thought process you have to go through. And there's not necessarily a right answer to some of that. Like, you know, maybe something is a class, or maybe something's just simply a field on something else. So, you may kind of evolve your thinking over time of, you know, exactly what the shape is of all these different entities. But that's really what I think of when I think of domain modeling. And, you know, some of that will cleanly map to database tables. And so you'll use something like Active Record for that. But then other things maybe won't. Like, it may be the concept in your mind, you know, isn't just a single database record. Maybe it's kind of the behavior that emerges from doing something across several different database records and tables and so forth. But this concept's really important. So, you know, you can model that concept as its own object or collection of objects. And, you know, they touch upon other database related models.
Yeah. I think early on in my Rails career, I made the mistake of thinking of an active record model and just the idea of a model as synonymous. And it took me a long time to realize that not all my models had to be active record models. And then at some point I realized that model is like a really broad idea, and like to take it to its most broad conceptualization or whatever, think about, okay, so here's how I define a model. And while you're talking, I was thinking of how I might word this. I think a model is like an approximation to the truth that is useful for interfacing with reality. So if we even go outside of programming and think about like scientists using models, like climatologists might make a computer model of the climate that's useful for making predictions and stuff like that. Their model of the climate doesn't attempt to simulate the climate. It's not like the computer has every like atom in the atmosphere programmed into it or something like that. They know that it's just an approximation to the truth, but it's just faithful enough to reality in order to be useful. And I think that maybe like going that far zoomed out and thinking about it outside of programming is useful, because then we come back and we're like, okay, what's a programming model? I've come across all these examples. I think I've ranted about this before on the show too, where you see an object-oriented programming example and they're like, oh, here's inheritance. We have a dog and we have a cat. They both inherit from animal. We can do cat.meow and dog.bark. But those aren't models, those are simulations. And we would never ever write a program where we have a cat and we type cat.meow, because that doesn't make any sense. We would model part of the cat, the part of the cat that we're interested in. So I think I even used the same exact example when I talked about it before. And I used the example of like a pet store. I mean, we might keep track of the cat's name, the cat's owner's name, the cat's birth date, some medical information or whatever, that kind of stuff. That's the model. And we're not even modeling the cat, you know, we're modeling something else. We're modeling like the history of the cat or something like that. Even though you might call that entity a pet, it's not like you're modeling the physical animal itself. You're just modeling the things that you care about. And I don't think there's any reason why there needs to be a particularly sharp distinction between active record models and Poro models. I put both those kinds right in app models, and it's just fine. There's no confusion between what's what, because a lot of times it doesn't even really matter that much. And when you're looking in the places it's used, you don't even really need to know always whether there's a database table behind that. So that's kind of how I think about models.
Yeah, that all makes sense to me. Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's hard to kind of come up on the spot with good examples of what is a, you know, what is a model or models that aren't active record models. But just based on experience, I usually find that those kind of things happen when you need to kind of zoom out from the data a little bit and kind of work at a higher level. So what I mean by that is, you know, you might have your active record models for things like you said, you know, a pet store and a pet and, you know, an owner who's buying a new pet and, you know, set up those relationships and so forth. But you might want to then do like higher level abstractions of like, you know, aggregations of, you know, the number of pets that are sold every day and report something like that, like generate a chart or, you know, so reporting analytics with social network kind of things, timelines are an example. Like you have lots of different timelines that kind of get constructed out of the raw data. So at that point, like you might be writing models that are, you know, live alongside your database, you know, table-based models, but themselves aren't, you know, tied to any particular database table. And I usually namespace all of that kind of stuff. So if, you know, if I go into app/models, you know, I might have a series of files that are just straight up active record models. But then I might have, you know, some folders, and within those folders are some Ruby files, or maybe even some more folders that then have Ruby files, and that all gets, you know, namespaced so it's properly auto-loaded and kind of grouped, you know. So anything that's around reporting, you know, might live in a reporting or reports or something like that kind of namespace. If something's around timelines, maybe there's a timeline namespace. And, you know, you can think of different examples, but just, you know, really using the tools we have within Ruby and within, you know, Rails and within, you know, the kind of structure that you can start out with. But, you know, thinking through, you know, okay, what are my sort of base layer database driven models? And then what are the kind of things I need to do at a higher level of abstraction to those models? And all that stuff can still live in models, but they're just kind of namespaced in their own areas of meaning, if you will. Does that resonate with you? Because I think that's kind of what you've said in the past around how you're structuring some of your code as well.
Yeah, I think so. And the namespacing aspect that you mentioned is something that I definitely utilize. I have several namespaces in my models folder, and my namespaces will like they'll be common between like controllers and like I have a billing namespace in my models folder. That I have a billing namespace in my controllers folder also. And inside models, I have both active record models and poros inside of each namespace. So that makes a lot of sense. All right, so I love talking about this stuff, and I think we could talk about this all day. There's so much more that I want to discuss and ask you about, but we're coming close to the hour mark, and I want to give you a chance to talk about Bridgetown. So can you tell us, first of all, what is Bridgetown?
Yeah, sure. So maybe I'll back up a little bit just to give you some history. So as I was learning Rails in the late 2000s, coming into the 2010s, you know, I was starting to use that to build applications, you know, working with clients on you know, these sort of, you know, Rails-specific applications. But the challenge I was having is some of the work I was doing and still wanted to keep doing was not so much a web application, but a website. And I know the delineation between the two is incredibly fuzzy and maybe even fuzzier as time goes by, but, you know, maybe call it like a marketing focused website or a publication versus an application where, you know, it's kind of behind logins and you have to log in and, you know, kind of work with data there. So it was increasingly bothering me that when I was working on websites, I would reach for something like WordPress, which is PHP and like totally different paradigms up and down the stack. And then when I was building a web application, I was using Ruby and using Rails. And so, you know, it got to the point where I was like, I can't handle working with WordPress anymore. I just, you know, the security problems, the performance problems, it was very frustrating. So I started to look into, you know, maybe there's a Rails-based CMS I can use. So the CMS side of things and the application side of things can all kind of be part of an overall stack. Unfortunately, at the time, there weren't a lot of good Rails-based CMSs, in my opinion. I am not sure if that's changed a whole lot in the time since, but I know, you know, there's at least some people are trying to build new projects that are going to be, you know, a good Rails-based CMS. So the dream is still alive. But for me, it was just really frustrating to try to figure out, you know, some way to harmonize the two. And then I came across Jekyll. And when I first saw Jekyll and I was hearing more and more people talking about this idea of static site generators, I didn't quite get it at first. But I, you know, I eventually, around 2016, started to look more at Jekyll closely. And it kind of dawned on me how much you could do with Jekyll out of the box, you know, with the liquid templates and with, you know, writing your own little plugins using Ruby and lots of other plugins people had already written. And kind of this approach of like, okay, I have a bunch of folders. Going back to the structure question, right? Like, it's always good to start with some kind of structure. So with Jekyll, it's like, okay, you have these folders with markdown files, and you have, you know, layout templates, and you have, you know, includes, which are kind of like partials to, you know, abstract stuff out into their own little files. And then, you know, you have this whole structure of all these files, and then you just type one command, and poof, everything gets processed and spit out to an output folder, and that output folder is the website, like the literal HTML, CSS, and JavaScript of the website, you know, as part of that build process. And you can deploy that as a singular artifact. You can, you know, copy it to S3 and serve it through Amazon. You can FTP it to your own web server, or as many people start to do and do now, you know, basically use Git so that, you know, every time you commit something new in the source files, the build process happens automatically through some kind of hosting solution, whether that's GitHub Pages itself or whether that's a service like Netlify or Versal or Render or any number of these sort of you know, static site generator friendly hosting providers. So anyway, so back in 2016 when I came across Jekyll, like, that solved so many problems for me in terms of, you know, oh, this is a great way to build websites and I can still work within a Ruby stack. I just don't have the editor part of it figured out. And I kind of solved that for a while, just building that myself inside of a Rails app. So if they already, you know, had a Rails app that, you know, did a number of things, I would just create a new section that was basically like website content, give them some simple editing fields, and then, you know, whatever they add or edit there, you know, gets turned into the under the hood into files that are inside of the Jekyll repo. And, you know, that worked on a few different projects. But as time went on, I felt like, you know, I want Jekyll to be able to do more. I want, you know, it to sort of integrate better with Rails or with the broader Ruby ecosystem in general. And instead of seeing Jekyll kind of doing that naturally as people were, you know, developing it as a software platform, instead it seemed like it was getting really stagnant. So in early 2020, right around the time as the pandemic was starting, what a crazy time. I reached out to the Jekyll folks through, you know, a GitHub issue and kind of just asked, like, you know, is there a roadmap? I have a few ideas of things I'd love to see in Jekyll. I'm willing to help out if that makes sense, you know, but I don't even know if there is a roadmap. You know, can we talk about that? And the word back at that time was basically that Jekyll was kind of in a maintenance mode. You know, there wasn't a whole lot of active development on it in terms of new features. Anyone that wants new features added to Jekyll kind of just needs to develop their own plugins. And, you know, it was basically like a, you know, sounds great, kid. Good luck. See ya. Which really startled me because, you know, I was at the point where I'd really been basing my own web studio, you know, agency, if you will, around this idea of building sort of hybrid Rails plus Jekyll projects, and to see one half of that be this thing that's maybe kind of not really going anywhere anymore really startled me. So gave it a lot of thought, got some input from some folks, and eventually realized that, you know, one option that was on the table is fork Jekyll and take it in a different direction. So during this crazy time of lockdown, when I was having a lot of free time on my hands all of a sudden, sitting in front of my computer. I was like, okay, what the heck? Fork Jekyll, try to add a few things, see if anyone is interested in it. And if not, you know, hey, it was a fun experiment. So very surprised to find out that a lot of people all of a sudden were expressing a lot of interest in this idea. So this fork of Jekyll became Bridgetown. The name Bridgetown is a nickname of Portland, which is where I live. So it's kind of a Portland theme to the code names. And it really, at this point, a year and a half later, it really has become, you know, most certainly a Jekyll Pro, if you will, but kind of has taken on its own identity and is really not so much competing with Jekyll per se, but competing with what we've seen a lot of activity going on over in the JavaScript community, where they're taking this idea of static site generator and kind of building a whole stack out of that, which is now being called the Jamstack, which if you talk to them, they'll advertise it essentially as competing with Rails. Like if you go to, you know, jamstack.org, I believe, and go look at that, go look at Netlify, look at projects like Next.js or Gatsby or some of these other large frameworks, they're billing it as a one-size-fits-all solution. You know, build a website, build a web application, build a SaaS app. It doesn't matter. You can use the same technology stack. We probably don't have time to get into all the reasons why they're saying that or all the reasons why I might think, you know, not all of it is the right approach. But the takeaway is this sort of basic idea that your website or even your web app is essentially kind of a base layer of a static site that's been pre-generated through a build process. And then as you interact with that, it starts, you know, pulling in data from APIs. It starts, you know, calling certain dynamic routes that you might write to do certain things. And, you know, it's kind of this almost like progressive enhancement, but from a backend perspective. This idea has become really powerful, and a lot of people are getting really excited about this sort of mindset around the Jamstack. So what I'm trying to do now with Bridgetown is essentially figure out a way to kind of take some of the best ideas from Jamstack thinking, but apply them in such a way that it makes sense to Ruby developers. You optionally can kind of pull Rails in to handle some of the API layer of that if you need to. And you know, it's an elaborate project. It's not done yet, but I think over the next few months and into next year, it's something that's really consuming a lot of my time and thinking, and I'm really excited about it.
And if anybody wants to go and find out more about Bridgetown or any other of the work you've done or anything else, where should they go?
Yeah, so Bridgetown is at bridgetownrb.com. And then my own company, White Fusion, is at whitefusion.studio. And the one also nice thing I'll mention about Bridgetown is we have a pretty active Discord chat there. And there's a few familiar faces there you might know if you're familiar with the Stimulus Reflex community. So there's been a little bit of crossover there, which is cool. Some crossover with people that have used Vue Component and Rails together, because Bridgetown also supports Vue Component, as well as its own native Ruby component thing that's basically Vue Component Lite, if you will. It's cool to see how kind of different parts of the Ruby community are coming together.
We'll put that stuff in the show notes. And Jared, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Oh, sure. Thanks for having me.